Okay, so I've been tasked with the usual topic of working out a new diagnostic and treatment strategies, I guess I should say, in the context of really emerging antimicrobial resistance. So this is an STI that really didn't get a lot of media attention until the last couple of years, and there's been quite a flurry really here and in the UK. As David nicely outlined, it's got a population prevalence that's really sitting around 1 to 2%, so very similar to chlamydia, and as David has also shown, really associated with similar clinical presentations and sequelae. Now, recent data from our group, but this mirrors the data from Sydney as well, shows that 1 in 10 asymptomatic gay men attending our service are infected, but more than 85% of those infections are macrolide resistant. If we look at asymptomatic women at our service, we were very surprised to see that it was 7%, and 1 in 2 of those infections were macrolide resistant. We know that sexual contacts of MG are likely to be infected, so it's about 1 in 2 women, 1 in 2 gay men, as long as you test the urethra and the rectum, about 1 in 3 heterosexual men. One of our PhD students, Rosie Latimer, has just completed a meta-analysis looking at MG prevalence by anatomical site in MSM, and the pooled estimate shows that it's about 5% at the urethra, it's about 6% at the rectum, and about 1% at the pharynx. Now, I think most people have heard this before. It doesn't have a cell wall. It's really hard to treat. We don't really have many classes of available antimicrobials that have activities. So we really only have a couple of targets to work with. That's the inhibition of protein synthesis. So for this, we've got macrolides, ketolides, streptogrammons, and to a lesser degree, tetracyclines, and inhibition of nucleic acid replication. And for this, we really only have the fourth generation fluoroquinolones, moxifloxacin and cetafloxacin. Most people here also know that azithromycin failures due to single nucleotide polymorphisms in the 23S ribosomal RNA gene. And because this organism has a single RNA gene operon encoding these subunits, a single mutation changes susceptibility from highly susceptible to highly resistant. And these SNPs are a really excellent marker of resistance to azithromycin. So unlike the data you heard this morning with gonorrhea and unlike quinolone resistance in MGen, it's really easy to use these as a target and to develop a resistance assay that will predict treatment failure to azithromycin. And we know that de novo resistance really occurs in as many as 12% of cases following 1 gram of azithromycin. Everyone's aware of Jane Hocking and Andrew Lau's meta-analysis that showed this really concerning decline in efficacy of 1 gram azithromycin from 85% in studies before 2009 down to 67% since. And moxifloxacin was a really effective agent when we first started using it in 2003. It was an absolute miracle drug. But within a few years, our first treatment failures emerged here and in Sydney, and a meta-analysis of 17 studies confirmed a decline in cure from 100% before 2010 down to 89%. And certainly in Melbourne and Sydney, we're sitting at around 15 to 20% failure. Now, quinolones target DNA gyrase and topoisomerase enzymes to inhibit DNA replication, and moxifloxacin failures are most consistently associated with mutations in the PAR-C subunit, particularly core regions 83 to 87. But alterations in the gyrase subunit of DNA gyrase have a less clearly defined role, but they're often concurrently detected with PAR-C mutations. There's been a lot of debate, you know, what are the key resistance mutations? Occasionally labs will be reporting quinolone resistance. It really hasn't been very well characterised yet. But recent data do indicate MOXIe-MICs and efficacy might be modified by concurrent gyrase mutations, and that they're certainly probably needed in addition to PAR-C for CIDR failure. So there hasn't been any surveillance for MG or antimicrobial resistance in any nation. People are slowly getting going. We're slowly getting going. The US is slowly getting going. WHO is interested. But Dorothy Matulek and our group recently completed a systematic review and meta-analysis on the prevalence of macrolide, quinolone and dual class resistance. This is currently under review at the moment. So our primary outcomes were really to look at, to generate some pooled estimates and country-specific and regional estimates for macrolide resistance, quinolone resistance using the mutations in the PAR-C gene and dual class resistance mutations. So in short, we have about 57 studies reporting macrolide resistant, 25 for fluoroquinolones and 22 for dual class. So this first figure shows regional and global trends in macrolide resistance. So what you can see, we've gone from 10% macrolide resistance in studies before 2010 globally up to 50% in the last couple of years. You can see this upward swing in Nordic countries. European data is a bit heterogeneous. But you can see this very concerning rise in the Western Pacific where we've gone from 10% to 70% and a similar picture in the US. While there's less fluoroquinolone data, we've gone from 5 to 9% globally. And again, you can see this very worrying rise in the Western Pacific. The Western Pacific really only represents data from Japan, New Zealand and Australia. Dual class resistance, sitting around 4%, not much in Europe, but again, this very concerning rise in the Western Pacific. Now, Dorothy put together these maps that show recent estimates for macrolide resistance, so country-specific estimates. And in dark brown, you can see here, these are the countries that have macrolide resistance in excess of 50%. So you can see North America, a number of European countries, and our Western Pacific, Japan, Australia and New Zealand. You can see a complete absence of data from large parts of the world. And concerningly, also a lot of these estimates are really just single studies, large single studies. We've got a recent study out of China that shows this very concerning prevalence of nearly 90%. Fluoroquinolone resistance, while we've got less data, the trends are a little bit easier to see. You can see, again, these estimates really in excess of 10% in the Americas and Western Pacific. But you can see it's a lot lower at about 4 to 5% in Europe. Again, this single estimate out of China showing 90% fluoroquinolone resistance. Now, dual class resistance, you can see here, sitting around sort of 10% in the Americas and Western Pacific, but really as low as 1 to 3% in Europe. So we're starting to see really big differences when it comes to quinolone and dual class resistance regionally. And again, we've got, you know, effectively 90% of infections in that particular Chinese study untreatable by recommended strategies. So we looked at antimicrobial resistance stratified by gender, and what we found was men had a high prevalence of macrolide resistance, of fluoroquinolone resistance and of dual class resistance. And we thought this was likely to be driven by sexual orientation. So we tried to obtain these data from authors and we certainly did confirm that MSM had significantly higher prevalence of macrolide resistance than heterosexual men, although that wasn't the case for fluoroquinolones and dual class. So the current situation we find ourselves in is azithromycin has been very widely used for a good couple of decades for chlamydia, gonorrhea, our STI syndromes and MG. And you've heard this morning, we've seen selection and spread of macrolide resistance that's not just limited to MG. We're seeing it for gonorrhea and syphilis. We've seen resistance emerge to our principal second-line agent, moxifloxacin, and really quinolone and dual-class resistance are highest in our region. And as clinicians, we're certainly diagnosing increasing numbers of infections that are challenging to cure and really some infections that are frankly untreatable. So in the absence of new drugs and lack of highly effective alternatives, a few years ago we developed an interim strategy to really try and curb the development of resistance. But we had to rely on existing antimicrobials within a novel algorithm and access to the first combined diagnostic resistance assay. So we developed a three-step approach. We stopped using azithromycin and switched to doxycycline for our syndromes. We adopted the SpeedX macrolide resistance assay prior to regulatory approval, and we implemented what we called sequence resistance-guided therapy. And we set ourselves a pretty ambitious goal, 95% cure, bearing in mind by this stage we were less than 50% frontline cure. But what really could we use, because doxy isn't very effective, but we hypothesised it would be likely to lower load and may improve the efficacy of a second agent if you delivered it straight afterwards. So we went for macrolide susceptible infections, we used 2.5 grams of azithromycin directly after doxy, and for macrolide resistance, we imported cetafloxacin, which has the most favourable MICs. So our pathway looked a bit like this. They came in with their syndrome, tested for chlamydia and MG. MG positives are recalled. We collected a subset of patients on doxy to look at their load. Macrolide susceptible patients had 2.5 grams of azithro, and macrolide resistance patients had cetafloxacin, and then everyone came back for their test of cure. So between August 2016 and May 2017, we treated 244 patients using this pathway. A third were susceptible and two-thirds were resistant. We did indeed achieve exactly a 95% cure using the doxy 2.5 gram strategy, so we were really delighted. And we achieved a 92% cure with doxycitofloxacin, and we were actually really pleased with that. Doxycycline achieved a significant reduction in load at a median of 13 doses, and de novo resistance dropped down to 2.6%. And given that it's about 12% following 1 gram, that's a big improvement. Now, we sequenced the samples in the macrolide-resistant group, and 20% of them had PAR-C mutations. So an 8% failure rate was really actually very good. So resistance-guided therapy really had a significant impact on practice and policy. We presented it in July 2017, and it was adopted by the UK and Australian guidelines within the year, but they substituted the more widely available moxifloxacin for cetafloxacin. And given the increase in quinolone resistance that you've just seen and the greater activity of cetafloxacin, it's really important we know how well moxifloxacin works in this pathway. So we repeated this study the following year, and we used moxifloxacin rather than cetafloxacin, and Chloe will present that in the next session or two this afternoon. What I can say is it's given us very robust evidence for this doxy 2.5 azithro strategy. Combined data from both studies has given us a pooled estimate of nearly 96% cure and a pooled estimate of de novo resistance that's actually less than 3%, significantly better than the 12% that we were working with 1 gram. Obviously, we can't really disentangle the contribution of doxy versus extended azithromycin to improving cure and reducing de novo resistance, but we think it's really likely both are contributing. And while we don't have any alternatives to azithromycin, it's really reasonable to use this strategy to minimise resistance. Cetafloxacin has more favourable MICs than moxi in cases with PAR-C mutations, but as I said, you'll have to wait for Chloe's talk to see how well that worked. So, last couple of slides. How do we manage MG in the context of escalating AMR? Well, certainly resistance-guided therapy has had a rapid impact on practice and policy. We're seeing a widespread reduction in the use of azithromycin. Europe, UK and Australia have recently prioritised doxy syndromically for in their guidelines, and the UK, as you know, has removed azithromycin from their gonococcal regimen. We do need to use resistance assays to individualise antimicrobial therapy for MG at the front line because it helps us optimise early high-level cure and promote stewardship. Next generation resistance assays that will include quinolone resistance assays, quinolone resistance targets, are a lot more challenging to develop, but they will really help us further refine algorithms and further optimise selection of antimicrobials. And next generation point of care assays that include resistance markers are in advanced development. And that's really going to be the game changer because that will facilitate etiologic resistance-guided therapy at presentation and help us individualise treatment for chlamydia and for MG and GC according to their susceptibility profile. Obviously, we need new drugs. There's a number in the pipeline. Those that are in the pipeline for gonorrhea are relevant too for MG, but we need to protect them. So we need to be looking at combination therapy approaches based on synergy data. And lastly, we need surveillance, and national and international efforts are underway. And I've been belting along there because I've been watching that timer go red. Okay, so we have a couple of disclosures. We have received research funding from SpeedX and research support from Hologic. And I'd like to thank everybody listed on the slide.